Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. The calendar may say it's fall, but the thermometer where I am says it's summer all the way. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Today, the verdict is in for a case we've been following on State of Belief for over a year now. We'll tell you the fate of the California church that caused major controversy with an anti-war sermon. Plus, why are Hindus from around the nation making a pilgrimage to a small town outside Atlanta, Georgia? And we've got some red lights to hand out in our intersection awards, including one to the congressman who said this.
Unfortunately, we have too many mosques in this country.
But first, we realize that we've got a bit of a theme going in today's show. As it turns out, every segment today deals in one way or another with houses of worship. We've got a story dealing with what one house of worship signifies to an entire faith community. Another focuses on the implications for all houses of worship following the closing of an IRS investigation. And so while we're embracing that theme, we thought we'd turn our attention to one house of worship right here in Washington, D.C. This weekend marks the 100th birthday of the Washington National Cathedral. It was on September 29, 1907, that President Teddy Roosevelt helped break ground for the building with these words, "Godspeed, the work begun this noon." The cathedral, which is part of the Episcopal Church, is familiar to many because of its yearly televised Mass on Christmas morning. Others recognize it as the location of several state funerals, including those of Presidents Eisenhower, Reagan, and Ford. But you may not know that the National Cathedral is officially just that, a national cathedral. Congress has designated it as the National House of Prayer. Well, what exactly does that mean in a pluralistic society? We're now joined by the current dean of Washington National Cathedral, the very Reverend Samuel Lloyd. Dean Lloyd, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Now, I understand that in addition to this weekend being the 100th birthday of the National Cathedral, it's also the 17th anniversary of the completion of construction on the cathedral. And for those who aren't good with quick math, what I'm saying is it took 83 years to get the cathedral built. Why did it take so long?
Great question. The answer is that just like just about every other cathedral, these are projects that call on what end up being multiple generations of devotion and commitment to get things done. In our case, it was a great vision of building a cathedral, a church to serve the nation. But the vision was big and grand and complicated, and it required that it be built step by step and stone by stone and then dollar by dollar as money would come in to continue along the way. So it was built across great depressions and world wars and ups and downs in the economy and ups and downs in the country, but they persisted. And so in 1990, they managed to cap it off and celebrate the completion of a remarkable achievement.
Well, now, in the dollar-for-dollar category, did you get federal dollars for the construction?
No, indeed. There is not a penny of federal money or, for that money, Episcopal Church money in terms of the National Episcopal Church. This was all done by personal donations through the years. And, in fact, our current life depends completely on finding donors who believe enough in what we're doing for the nation to want to support us.
Hmm. In 1791, George Washington commissioned a design plan for Washington, D.C., which included a church that was, and I'm reading here, intended for national purposes such as public prayer, thanksgiving, funeral orations, and so forth, and assigned to the special use of no particular sect or denomination, but equally open to all. Now, even though Dean, the National Cathedral is part of the Episcopal Church of the United States. Do you feel it remains true to that original intention?
Well, it does, all in all. You know, the church that Pierre L'Enfant imagined, he's the one who did the study for George Washington, never materialized. It went for 100 years without anything happening there because of our clear separation of church and state. And so, in essence, what happened was the Episcopal Church stepped into the breach, saw a need for a sacred place for the nation, and without any formal charge from the government or anyone else to do it, decided to build a great big sacred space that would be, by definition, a house of prayer for all people, grounded in the Episcopal tradition and living out of that, but offering itself in an ecumenically and interfaith way for the rest of the country.
Is the liturgy in the National Cathedral just the same as it is in any other Episcopal church?
No, it's very similar. But what we try to do is to create a service that is clearly Episcopal in its shaping and understanding. But we use special prayers, special words, even special liturgical actions sometimes to reach across pure denominational boundaries. We want this to be a service that certainly within the Christian world can speak comfortably to Presbyterians and Catholics and Methodists and disciples and Baptists, and that they can each find a place for themselves in it. So we'll sing, for example, in our big celebration this Sunday, we're going to sing one of the grandest of the great Baptist hymns, as a way, "Great is Thy Faithfulness," as a way of gathering in a major piece of the nation that really believes in what we're doing.
Dean Lloyd, let's take that one step further. What are some examples of the cathedral's approach to interfaith issues or interreligious issues?
We take those very seriously here. We are very much committed to being a place where interfaith dialogue goes on, interfaith learning goes on, and interfaith action takes place. For example, we have as an ongoing part of our annual life something we call the Abrahamic Roundtable, which brings together Jewish, Christian, and Muslim clergy and scholars each year to wrestle with a particular piece of the tradition, what the holy texts have to say, for example, about the treatment of the widow and the orphan, or about war and peace. And out of that often comes public presentations and even pamphlets and essays sometimes. We carry on interfaith book clubs here, interfaith dialogues when major issues come up. Part of it is ongoing scholarly exploration and more personal exploration.
We're talking to the very Reverend Samuel Lloyd, Dean of Washington National Cathedral. You can find out more about the cathedral's 100th birthday at stateofbelief.com. And Dean Lloyd, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you. A pleasure to be with you.
Still to come, after more than 2 years of investigation by the IRS, what's the status of All Saints Church in Pasadena, California? And up next, what turned Georgia into an epicenter of Hinduism in America? Stay tuned. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio.
The Interfaith Alliance, defending democratic values and promoting religious liberty. Learn more at interfaithalliance.org.
So glad, so glad I got good religion. So glad I got good religion.
And now it's time for
Meet the
faith.
State of Beliefs look at our one nation of many faiths in 2 minutes or less. This week's faith is
Hinduism.
Hinduism is the world's oldest existent religion. Its origins on the Indian subcontinent trace back more than 7,500 years, and there isn't any known founder of Hinduism. It remains a diverse faith tradition with several overlapping philosophies and no overriding creed or authority. Most Hindus believe that the spirit or the soul is eternal. The goal of existence in Hinduism is liberation from the cycle of rebirth and death and entrance into the indescribable state of moksha. Dharma is a central concept to Hinduism, signifying the underlying order in nature and living in accord with that order. God is known as Brahman. In some Hindu traditions, Brahman is a supreme being. In others, Brahman is regarded as an infinite principle.
By the numbers!
There are approximately 1 billion Hindus worldwide. 905 million of them live in India and Nepal. It's the world's third largest religion after Christianity and Islam.
Worship!
Hindus can engage in worship either at home or at a temple. At home, Hindus often create a shrine. Temples are usually dedicated to a primary deity, though some commemorate multiple deities. Hindus perform their worship through icons, such as statues or paintings, symbolic of God's power and glory.
Famous firsts!
Among their vast contributions to the world, Hindus are credited with establishing the first university. They also came up with the hypothesis that planets in the solar system circle around the sun, and they're responsible for the first detailed text on surgery. And that's Hinduism in 2 minutes or less. Give yourselves a big round of applause for learning something new and join us next time for
Meet the Faith.
This is State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. That edition of Meet the Faith was produced with the consultation of Rajan Zed, the Hindu chaplain from Nevada, who recently delivered the opening prayer from the floor of the United States Senate. When Chaplain Zed was on the show a few months ago, we talked a bit about Hinduism and how Hinduism is still somewhat foreign to many Americans. Part of understanding the beliefs of any particular religious group is understanding the traditions that come along with them. Nowhere are those traditions on a better display than in the Atlanta suburb of Lilburn, Georgia. The town is home to a brand new Hindu temple, which is the largest of its kind in America, and only the fifth traditional stone temple outside of India. Thousands of visitors from across the country already have taken the trip to Lilburn to see the new temple in its first month of operation. With us right now by phone from Maryland is Ishani Chowdhury, Executive Director of the Hindu American Foundation. Recently, I spent a wonderful evening with members of the Hindu American Foundation under the Great Dome of the United States Capitol, and I learned of the great work that the HAF is doing in our nation. Ishani Chowdhury joins us right now to tell us more about the significance of this new Hindu temple in Atlanta and other Hindu temples in America. Ishani, welcome to State of Belief.
Hi, thank you for allowing us the opportunity to speak today. And I'm very glad that you had the opportunity to attend our annual reception on the Hill.
Well, thank you. Now tell me, why is this $19 million temple located in a small Georgia suburb?
Well, the Hindu American population in the United States has been steadily increasing through the past 50 to 60 years. Hindus number approximately 2 million in the United States. And the largest number of Hindus you can find tend to be in urban areas such as New York or in California and New Jersey. But there are also a significant number of Hindus that are living in not so populated areas as before, particularly in the case of Georgia. As we've seen, a lot of these Hindus tend to move there because of wonderful employment opportunities. And as we see, the Hindu temple really serves as a focal point for the community who have come from abroad and really want to preserve and enrich their culture and heritage. And living in areas such as Georgia, you know, provides an excellent opportunity for the Hindu community to come together and pool their funds and resources and purchase land to build a temple the way temples are traditionally built in India, which is built carved from stone. They're basically chiseled by stone artisans who have mastered the craft of ancient Hindu architecture.
The leaders at the Lilburn Temple say They want the temple to be used by people of all faiths for use during natural disasters, educational services, and so forth. Is that a common trait of Hindu temples?
Well, the beauty of Hinduism is that it has a long history of pluralism and tolerance. And what the temple leaders are doing is basically extending that and continuing on that tradition. There have been temples, and there continue to be temples that do serve as points for many different faiths to come together and join under one roof. Particularly, there is a temple here in the Maryland area. It's the Washington Kali Temple that actually has an interfaith hall and meditation center. So this is just another example of a temple, perhaps on a larger scale, that is following the same path.
Well, let me move from that particular interest to a more general one. I know that the Hindu American Foundation is working hard with elected leaders on legislation that means a great deal to Hindus in this nation. Tell our listeners a little about the priorities on that agenda.
One of the biggest things that we see is the festival of Diwali, which is probably the most celebrated festival in the Hindu world. This year, it falls on Friday, November 9th. And Diwali basically is a festival that symbolizes the lighting of knowledge and the triumph of good over evil. And it is celebrated in every nook and corner in India and abroad. And it's one of the most common festivals celebrated in the United States, and particularly at the Hindu temples. And what we really like to see is for Congress in spirit to really recognize Diwali. And what we've done is introduce two resolutions on the Hill. And the resolution basically asks Congress to recognize the symbolism of Diwali not only for Hindu Americans, but for Jains and Sikh Americans as well, and really ask the president to issue a proclamation recognize the significance of this festival. This is the second time we've introduced it, and we're hoping that a lot of members of Congress will co-sponsor and sign on to this resolution.
We've got more information on this congressional resolution at stateofbelief.com. I hope our listeners will go there and check it out. And Ishani Chowdhury is executive director of the Hindu American Foundation. Shani, thank you for joining us on State of Belief.
Thank you again for your time, and we hope that the listeners will take an opportunity to learn about more about the Hindu American Foundation. They can visit us at www.hafsite.org. That's halfsite.org.
Coming up next, an anti-war sermon prompted a two-year investigation by the IRS. What does the future hold for the church that's under the microscope? I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief on Air America Radio.
State of Belief, once a week, not enough? Check out our website, stateofbelief.com.
Political campaigns have every incentive into misleading churches and other tax-exempt organizations into violating law. They're not the ones at risk. The only danger is to the church, and the political organization gets what it needs from the church, and then it's the church that are left, churches that are left to take the consequences.
This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. And that was a clip from our show that aired 1 year ago this weekend. Our legal expert, John Pomerantz, was explaining the conundrum of mixing politics and religion. That dangerous combination is what got one church in Pasadena, California, into trouble with the IRS. Let's remind everyone of what happened. In 2004, 2 days before the presidential election, the congregation of All Saints Episcopal Church heard a sermon delivered by George Regas, a former rector of All Saints. The sermon was called, "If Jesus Debated Senator Kerry and President Bush," and it included hypothetical questions from Jesus and answers from the two presidential candidates. The church received a letter from the IRS nearly a year later, claiming that the sermon was under investigation and that All Saints was in danger of losing its tax-exempt status. Although Reverend Regas didn't endorse a candidate in his sermon, the IRS still felt that the content may have constituted interference in an election by a house of worship. Well, after more than 2 years of investigating, the IRS has informed All Saints that it's closing the case and that the church will not lose its tax-exempt status. But as clear-cut as that sounds, there's still much cloudiness surrounding this case and its implications. Joining us right now by phone from Pasadena, California, is the rector of All Saints Church, my good friend, Reverend Ed Bacon. Ed, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you, Weldon.
Now, help me understand something. The IRS says it's closing the investigation and All Saints tax-exempt status is secure, but then it also says that George's sermon was illegal. How does that make sense?
It's intrinsically nonsensical, isn't it? That is what we are calling for a correction about and also clarification about. And then while we're in communication, we're asking for an apology for this entire sordid mess.
Did this investigation strike you as unusual from the very beginning?
It did. It came from out of the blue. It was a clear misinterpretation of IRS regulations, which I happen to embrace and have embraced in my entire career of 30 years. The church should never be a partisan place. No religious organization in America should be identified with any particular party. And we should always have injunctions about endorsing candidates. And we've always done that at All Saints, and we've always done that in my career. And we cannot be the body of Jesus and the body of Christ without critiquing and also lifting up those values that Jesus did. So that means that you have to be involved in policy advocacy and criticism, and it's important to call and name names when there are particular folks attached to those policies. That's what we were doing. That's what George Regas's sermon did. And he was so very careful not to tell people how to vote. That's what we always do. So it was absolute puzzlement to us. And we always thought that there must be something else going on.
Well, Ed, do you have a hunch that the investigation was politically motivated?
I have a question. I wouldn't say a hunch, but I have some very serious questions that I have held throughout this entire episode. But as you probably know, not only was this letter very troubling to us in terms of its vagueness, its contradictoriness, and maybe it's even capriciousness, but we filed a Freedom of Information Act inquiry and found and were received amongst a lot of redacted and edited materials that showed that the Department of Justice and the IRS were consulting with one another at an early stage, long before we even contemplated refusing to comply with the administrative summonses we had requested. So in light of the fact that Mr. Gonzalez's Department of Justice was highly partisanized, and that's the reason he left the Department of Justice, it certainly raises issues about whether or not there was a politicization of our inquiry.
Ed, I don't know where I saw this. You've been quoted in so many different places, but there was one quote of yours that made me think you do have a hunch that the result of this investigation would have been different if there had been a different outcome in the 2006 elections. Is that right?
Well, I have raised the concern about the 2006 elections. Clearly, a mandate was sent to Congress and to the White House that we needed to get out of this war. I think that there was a secondary mandate having to do with the erosion of civil liberties in this country as a result of this immoral and illegal war that is crippling us so much, and that we've lost so much in terms of basic human freedoms. And I think the electorate sent a message about that that could have had and might have had a reverse chilling effect, actually, on the Department of Justice and the IRS.
I'm talking with my good friend, Reverend Ed Bacon, who is the rector of All Saints Church in Pasadena, California. Ed, You talked about you've asked for clarification. Have you had any clarification from the IRS or the Treasury Department that would help you understand what went on and help others understand what is and isn't appropriate at the pulpit?
Quite the contrary. I think that we are in a murkier area now, and clearly we're seeing even through more of a glass darkly than when we began this episode. Since the recent media attention to our case, the IRS has refused to respond to media inquiries based on the confidentiality law, protecting the confidentiality of taxpayers. That's fine with me. I support confidentiality of taxpayers' identities. I just wish the IRS would get consistent about it and would have kept our identity confidential and had not gone to the Department of Justice prior to it was time for them to go. The second concern I have that is even more troubling is the statement that was released by the IRS, I think this past Sunday, saying that they were going to be working with churches and religious institutions as we approach the 2008 presidential election cycle to make sure that people were not in infraction of the IRS regulations. The cleanest, clearest, most helpful thing that they could do would be to drop our case, to send us another letter saying, of course, your taxpayer situation has not changed, a no change letter. But without that very contradictory and confusing statement about this particular sermon.
Well, is the ruling too vague to have an impact, or is there anything about this ruling that has meaning for other houses of worship?
One of the striking experiences I've had this week, just in these 4 days since Sunday's sermon and announcement, is I have had an amazing amount of email and written correspondence, snail mail correspondence, and a significant percentage of it is coming from clergy. And they are saying that All Saints, that how much they appreciate All Saints taking the stand and how vulnerable they feel. This is not about All Saints Church. This is about the American pulpit. Mm-hmm. I have never felt that I was fighting just for myself on this. And my people don't feel that. They get it, that this is about conservative pulpits, liberal pulpits, other pulpits in other religious organizations. All of us need, and this country needs, for religious institutions to be free to be the conscience of the state, to quote Dr. King. And to the degree that there's vagueness out there and people don't know whether they would get in trouble for saying this or that, really is an erosion of the freedom of speech and the freedom of religion in this country. And it's something that we cannot long stand without having a significant decrease in the democracy quotient of America.
Ed, let me ask you a personal question. I know you well enough to know what your priorities are and what you like to do in terms of pastoral and prophetic and preaching ministry. What has this whole thing done to you?
Well, it's been a very sobering experience of communicating to me that every citizen has a responsibility to fight for the First Amendment. And on a larger scale, the entire principle of democracy and those essential elements of radical accountability and checks and balances and transparency that must exist for human beings to thrive. Freedom is essential for humanity, for each of us to know why God put us on this planet, the particular unique, glorious set of gifts that God gave each one of us. And people can't do that if they live in fear. And that's the genius of democracy. And the major thing it has called me to with even greater energy than ever before is to practice what I call Christian patriotism. And that is to say, this does not fly in terms of the principles of democracy. So that's the biggest thing it's done for me. It's given us here at All Saints a tremendous platform that we otherwise would not have had. So in that way, it's been a blessing. And then in terms of the disadvantages, I really love to go to the hospital and pray with people and hold their hands and do spiritual direction, spiritual counseling. And I've had to reorganize our entire staff so that all my colleagues are doing more of that than I am. Mm-hmm. So those are that's just a taste of the change in my own personal life.
Reverend Ed Bacon is the rector of All Saints Church in Pasadena, California. Ed, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief.
It was an honor to be invited. Thank you, Walt.
Up next, you probably won't see Congressman Peter King going into a mosque anytime soon, but you'll hear us give him a red light in our Intersection Awards. Coming up next, I'm Welton Gaddy. Stay with us. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio.
And now, the wisdom of Congressman Peter King, as State of Belief presents another installment of In Their Own Words.
Unfortunately, we have too many mosques in this country.
And that's In Their Own Words, here on State of Belief.
Well, welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. And that comment from Congressman King leads us right into this week's Intersection Awards, our very own traffic lights at the intersection of religion and politics. On a day when our show is focusing on diversity among houses of worship, it should come as no surprise that we're giving Peter King a red light for saying that there are too many mosques in this country. But perhaps even worse than saying it once was saying it again, and then trying to claim that he was taken out of context both times. Well, let's review the context, shall we? Here's Congressman King speaking to an interviewer at Politico.com about national security.
If there's any doubt, I want the doubt resolved in favor of us going out and getting the job done. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we have too many mosques in this country. There's too many people who are sympathetic to radical Islam. We should be looking at them more carefully. We should be finding out how we can infiltrate. We should be much more aggressive in law enforcement.
Well, now, at this point in the interview, King stopped to take a phone call. But when the question started up again, we hear a familiar refrain.
He called right as you were saying, you know, that striking the balance between civil liberties and that there's too many mosques in the country.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are. I mean, I'm aware of ones in New York where, to me, they certainly raise suspicion. They should be looked at carefully. I think there's been a lack of full cooperation from too many people in the Muslim community.
Politico has the entire video posted on its website. Go watch it. And you'll see that the quote is completely in context. In fact, there's no context to take it out of. They posted the whole thing. And it sounds exactly like what you just heard, an elected representative using his narrow opinions to stereotype an entire religious tradition. Now, one more quick red light before we go. If you watched Wednesday night's presidential debate in New Hampshire, right up until the end, you would have seen moderator Tim Russert ask the Democratic candidates for president, "What is your favorite Bible verse?" Russert and the candidates all get red lights. Russert for asking the question, and the candidates for continuing to play into the religious tests imposed by the media. A far better question to ask the candidates would have been, how do you balance the principles of your faith and your pledge to defend the Constitution, particularly when the two come into conflict? And finally, a welcome change of pace. The Federal Bureau of Prisons, under pressure from Congress, religious leaders, and civil libertarians, has decided to return religious materials it had removed from prison libraries and chapels. But now look, we're only giving them a yellow light, not a green, because the Bureau of Prisons is still considering creating a list of acceptable religious books. Until we see clear guidelines that protect the rights of all prisoners, we will be keeping a close eye on how this issue progresses. Now, before we go, we have to acknowledge the United States Senate for the passage of the hate crimes bill, which has already made it through the House. Now, I must warn you that in that jubilation is also caution. The fight's not over. With the threat of a presidential veto, work still needs to be done to make this bill veto-proof. We're going to continue to fight for that possibility. As Senator Kennedy mentioned on the floor of the Senate, the Interfaith Alliance has played a leading role in promoting this important legislation. And although they make a lot of noise, only a handful of religious right extremists oppose this bill. Putting politics before public safety, they have told numerous lies about the implications of the bill in order to defeat it. But people of faith support this bill in wide margins, as do the American people overall. To be sure, legislation alone can't remove hatred from our midst. But passage of comprehensive hate crimes legislation will send a clear message about America's common values that we utterly reject hate violence and embrace an America in which diverse people are safe as well as free. Well, that's our show for this week. Is there something you want us to know about your house of worship? Tell us about it by going to stateofbelief.com, where you can send us an email. Or you can call us, 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. Who knows? We may ask you to come on the show to share your story with everybody. State of Belief is produced by the Interfaith Alliance Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, which means this show is supported by members of the Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. And while you're there, why don't you think about becoming more than a listener? Become a member of the Interfaith Alliance. Well, until next week, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.